This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Midnight Library by Matt Haig. Read for you by Carey Mulligan. To all the health workers and the care workers, thank you. I can never be all the people I want and live all the lives I want. I can never train myself in all the skills I want. And why do I want? I want to live and feel all the shades, tones and variations of mental and physical experience possible in my life. Sylvia Plath. Between life and death there is a library, she said, and within that library the shelves go on forever. Every book provides a chance to try another life you could have lived, to see how things would be if you'd made other choices. Would you have done anything different if you had the chance to undo your regrets? A conversation about rain. 19 years before she decided to die, Nora Seed sat in the warmth of the small library at Hazeldean School in the town of Bedford. She sat at a low table staring at a chessboard. Nora, dear, it's natural to worry about your future, said the librarian, Mrs. Elm, her eyes twinkling. Mrs. Elm made her first move, a knight hopping over the neat row of white pawns. Of course you're going to be worried about the exams, but you could be anything you want to be, Nora. Think of all that possibility. It's exciting. Yes, I suppose it is. A whole life in front of you. A whole life. You could do anything. Live anywhere. Somewhere a bit less cold and wet. Nora pushed a pawn forward 2 spaces. It was hard not to compare Mrs. Elm to her mother, who treated Nora like a mistake in need of correction. For instance, when she was a baby, her mother had been so worried Nora's left ear stuck out more than her right that she'd used sticky tape to address the situation, then disguised it beneath a woolen bonnet. I hate the cold and wet, added Mrs. Elm for emphasis. Mrs. Elm had short grey hair and a kind and mildly crinkled oval face, sitting pale above her turtle green polo neck. She was quite old, but she was also the person most on Nora's wavelength in the entire school. And even on days when it wasn't raining, she would spend her afternoon break in the small library. Coldness and wetness don't always go together, Nora told her. Antarctica is the driest continent on Earth. Technically, it's a desert. Well, that sounds up your street. I don't think it's far enough away. Well, maybe you should be an astronaut. Travel the galaxy. Nora smiled. The rain is even worse on other planets. Worse than Bedfordshire. On Venus, it is pure acid. Mrs. Elm pulled a paper tissue from her sleeve and delicately blew her nose. See? With a brain like yours, you can do anything. A blonde boy Nora recognized from a couple of years below her ran past outside the rain-speckled window, either chasing someone or being chased. Since her brother had left, she'd felt a bit unguarded out there. The library was a little shelter of civilization. Dad thinks I've thrown everything away. Now I've stopped swimming. Well, far be it from me to say that there is more to this world than swimming really fast. There are many different possible lives ahead of you. Like I said last week, you could be a glaciologist. I've been researching, and it was then that the phone rang. 1 minute, said Mrs. Elm softly. I'd better get that. A moment later, Nora watched Mrs. Elm on the phone. Yes, she's here now. The librarian's face fell in shock. She turned away from Nora, but her words were audible across the hushed room. Oh, no. No. Oh, my God. Of course. 19 years later. The man at the door. 27 hours before she decided to die, Nora Seed sat on her dilapidated sofa scrolling through other people's happy lives, waiting for something to happen. And then, out of nowhere, something actually did. Someone, for whatever peculiar reason, rang her doorbell. She wondered for a moment if she shouldn't get the door at all. She was, after all, already in her nightclothes, even though it was only 9 p.m. She felt self-conscious about her oversized eco-warrior t-shirt and her tartan pajama bottoms. She put on her slippers, to be slightly more civilized, and discovered that the person at the door was a man, and one she recognized. He was tall and gangly and boyish, with a kind face, but his eyes were sharp and bright, like they could see through things. It was good to see him, if a little surprising, especially as he was wearing sports gear and he looked hot and sweaty despite the cold, rainy weather. The juxtaposition between them made her feel even more slovenly than she had done 5 seconds earlier. But she'd been feeling lonely, and though she'd studied enough existential philosophy to believe loneliness was a fundamental part of being human in an essentially meaningless universe, it was good to see him. "Ash," she said, smiling. "It's Ash, isn't it?" "Yes, it is." "What's she doing here?" "It's good to see you." A few weeks earlier, she'd been sat playing her electric piano, and he'd run down Bancroft Avenue and had seen her in the window. He had once, years ago, asked her out for a coffee. Maybe he was about to do that again. "It's good to see you too," he said, but his tense forehead didn't show it. When she'd spoken to him in the shop, he'd always sounded breezy, but now his voice contained something heavy. He scratched his brow, made another sound, but didn't quite manage a full word. "You running?" A pointless question. He was clearly out for a run. But he seemed relieved, momentarily, to have something trivial to say. "Yeah, I'm doing the Bedford Half. It's this Sunday." "Oh, right. Great. I was thinking of doing a half marathon, and then I remembered I hate running." This had sounded funnier in her head than it did as actual words being vocalized out of her mouth. She didn't even hate running. But still, she was perturbed to see the seriousness of his expression. The silence went beyond awkward into something else. "You told me you had a cat," he said eventually. "Yes, I have a cat." I remembered his name. "Voltaire? A ginger tabby?" "Yeah, I call him Volts." He finds Voltaire a bit pretentious. Turns out he's not massively into 18th century French philosophy and literature. He's quite down to earth, you know, for a cat. Ash looked down at her slippers. "I'm afraid I think he's dead."
"What?"
"He's lying very still by the side of the road. I saw the name on the collar. I think a car might have hit him. I'm sorry, Nora." She was so scared of her sudden switch in emotions right then that she kept smiling, as if the smile could keep her in the world she'd just been in, the one where Volts was alive and where this man she'd sold guitar songbooks to had rung her doorbell for another reason. Ash, she remembered, was a surgeon. Not a veterinary one, a general human one. If he said something was dead, it was, in all probability, dead. "I'm so sorry." Nora had a familiar sense of grief. Only the sertraline stopped her crying. "Oh, God." She stepped out onto the wet, cracked paving slabs of Bancroft Avenue, hardly breathing, and saw the poor ginger-furred creature lying on the rain-glossed tarmac beside the curb. His head grazed the side of the pavement, and his legs were back as if in mid-gallop, chasing some imaginary bird.
"Oh, Volts. Oh, no. Oh, God."
She knew she should be experiencing pity and despair for her feline friend, and she was. But she had to acknowledge something else. As she stared at Voltaire's still and peaceful expression, that total absence of pain, There was an inescapable feeling brewing in the darkness. Envy. String theory. 9.5 hours before she decided to die, Nora arrived late for her afternoon shift at String Theory. "I'm sorry," she told Neil in the scruffy little windowless box of an office. "My cat died last night, and I had to bury him. Well, someone helped me bury him, but then I was left alone in my flat and I couldn't sleep and forgot to set the alarm and didn't wake up till midday and then had to rush." This was all true, and she imagined her appearance, including makeup-free face, loose makeshift ponytail, and the same second-hand green corduroy pinafore dress she had worn to work all week, garnished with a general air of tired despair, would back her up. Neil looked up from his computer and leaned back in his chair. He joined his hands together and made a steeple of his index fingers, which he placed under his chin, as if he was Confucius contemplating a deep philosophical truth about the universe, rather than the boss of a musical equipment shop dealing with a late employee. There was a massive Fleetwood Mac poster on the wall behind him, the top right corner of which had come unstuck and flopped down like a puppy's ear. "Listen, Nora, I'd like you." Neil was harmless, a 50-something guitar aficionado who liked cracking bad jokes and playing passable old Dylan covers live in the store. "And I know you've got mental health stuff. Everyone's got mental health stuff. You know what I mean." "I'm feeling much better generally," she lied. "It's not clinical. The doctor says it's situational depression. It's just that I keep on having new situations. But I haven't taken a day off sick for it all. Apart from when my mum..." "Yeah, apart from that." Neil sighed, but when he did so, made a whistling sound out of his nose. An ominous B-flat. "Nora, how long have you worked here?" 12 years and, she knew this too well, 11 months and 3 days, on and off. "That's a long time. I feel like you're made for better things. You're in your late 30s. "I'm 35. "You've got so much going for you. You teach people piano." "One person." He brushed a crumb off his sweater. "Did you picture yourself stuck in your hometown working in a shop? You know, when you were 14, what did you picture yourself as?" "At 14? A swimmer." She'd been the fastest 14-year-old girl in the country at breaststroke and second fastest at freestyle. She remembered standing on a podium at the National Swimming Championships. "So what happened?" She gave the short version. "It was a lot of pressure." "Pressure makes us, though. You start off as coal and the pressure makes you a diamond." She didn't correct his knowledge of diamonds. She didn't tell him that while coal and diamonds are both carbon, coal is too impure to be able, under whatever pressure, to become a diamond. According to science, you start off as coal and you end up as coal. Maybe that was the real life lesson. She smoothed a stray strand of her coal-black hair up towards her ponytail. "What are you saying, Neil?" "It's never too late to pursue a dream." "Pretty sure it's too late to pursue that one." "You're a very well-qualified person, Nora. Degree in philosophy." Nora stared down at the small mole on her left hand. That mole had been through everything she'd been through, and it just stayed there. Not caring. Just being a mole. "Not a massive demand for philosophers in Bedford, if I'm honest, Neil." "You went to uni. Had a year in London, then came back." "I didn't have much of a choice." Nora didn't want the conversation about her dead mum. Or even Dan. Because Neil had found Nora's backing out of a wedding with 2 days' notice the most fascinating love story since Kurt and Courtney. "We all have choices, Nora. There's such a thing as free will." "Well, not if you subscribe to a deterministic view of the universe." "But why here?" "It was either here or the Animal Rescue Center. This paid better, plus, you know, music. You were in a band with your brother.
I was. The Labyrinths. We weren't really going anywhere.
Your brother tells a different story.
This took Nora by surprise.
Joe? How do you...
He bought an amp. Marshall DSL-40.
When?
Friday.
He was in Bedford.
Unless it was a hologram, like Tupac.
He was probably visiting Ravi, Nora thought. Ravi was her brother's best friend. While Joe had given up the guitar and moved to London for a crap IT job he hated, Ravi had stuck to Bedford. He played in a covers band now, called Slaughterhouse 4, doing pub gigs around town.
Right. That's interesting.
Nora was pretty certain her brother knew Friday was her day off. The fact prodded her from inside.
I'm happy here.
Except you aren't.
He was right. A soul sickness festered within her. Her mind was throwing itself up. She widened her smile.
I mean, I am happy with the job.
Happy as in, you know,
satisfied. Neil, I need this job.
You are a good person. You worry about the world, the homeless, the environment. I need a job.
He was back in his Confucius pose.
You need freedom.
I don't want freedom.
This isn't a non-profit organization.
Though I have to say, it's rapidly becoming one.
Look, Neil, is this about what I said the other week, about you needing to modernize things? I've got some ideas of how to get young people...
No, he said defensively. This place used to just be guitars. String theory, get it? I diversified, made this work. It's just that when times are tough, I can't pay you to put customers off with your face looking like a wet weekend.
What?
I'm afraid, Nora.
He paused for a moment. About the time it takes to lift an axe into the air.
I'm going to have to let you go.
To live is to suffer. 9 hours before she decided to die, Nora wandered around Bedford aimlessly. The town was a conveyor belt of despair. The Pebble Dash Sports Centre where her dead dad once watched her swim lengths of the pool. The Mexican restaurant where she'd taken Dan for fajitas. The hospital where her mum had her treatment. Dan had texted her yesterday.
Nora, I miss your voice. Can we talk?
D. Kiss. She'd said she was stupidly hectic.
Big lol.
Yet it was impossible to text anything else. Not because she didn't still feel for him, but because she did. And she couldn't risk hurting him again. She'd ruined his life.
My life is chaos, he'd told her, via drunk text shortly after the would-be wedding she'd pulled out of 2 days before.
The universe tended towards chaos and entropy. That was basic thermodynamics.
Maybe it was basic existence, too.
You lose your job, then more shit happens. The wind whispered through the trees. It began to rain. She headed towards the shelter of the newsagents with the deep and, as it happened, correct, sense that things were about to get worse.
Doors.
8 hours before she decided to die, Nora entered the newsagents.
Sheltering from the rain? The woman behind the counter asked.
Yes. Nora kept her head down, her despair growing like a weight she couldn't carry. A National Geographic was on display. As she stared now at the magazine cover, an image of a black hole, she realized that's what she was. A black hole, a dying star collapsing in on itself. Her dad used to subscribe. She remembered being enthralled by an article about Svalbard, the Norwegian archipelago in the Arctic Ocean. She'd never seen a place that looked so far away. She'd read about scientists doing research among glaciers and frozen fjords and puffins. Then, prompted by Mrs. Elm, she decided she wanted to be a glaciologist. She saw the scruffy, hunched form of her brother's friend and their own former bandmate,
Ravi by the music mags, engrossed in an article. She stood there for a fraction too long, because when she walked away, she heard him say, "Nora?" "Ravi, hi. I hear Joe was in Bedford the other day." A small nod. "Yeah." Did you see him?"
"I did, actually."
A silence Nora felt as pain. "He didn't tell me he was coming. It was just a flyby."
"Is he okay?"
Ravi paused. Nora had once liked him, and he'd been a loyal friend to her brother. But as with Joe, there was a barrier between them. They hadn't parted on the best of terms. He'd thrown his drumsticks on the floor of a rehearsal room and stropped out when Nora told him she was out of the band. "I think he's depressed." Nora's mind grew heavier at the idea her brother might feel like she did. "He's not himself," Ravi went on, anger in his voice. "He's going to have to move out of his shoebox in Shepherd's Bush, what with him not being able to play lead guitar in a successful rock band. Mind you, I've got no money either. Pub gigs don't pay these days, even when you agree to clean the toilets."
"Ever cleaned pub toilets, Nora?"
"I'm having a pretty shit time too, if we're doing the Misery Olympics." Ravi Koff laughed. A hardness momentarily shadowed his face. "The world's smallest violin is playing." She wasn't in the mood. "Is this about the labyrinths, still?"
"It meant a lot to me, and to your brother, to all of us. We had a deal with Universal, right there. Album, singles, tour, promo. We could be Coldplay now."
"You hate Coldplay."
"Not the point. We could be in Malibu. Instead, Bedford. And so no, your brother's not ready to see you."
"I was having panic attacks. I'd have let everyone down in the end. I told the label to take you on without me. I agreed to write the songs. It wasn't my fault I was engaged. I was with Dan. It was kind of a deal breaker."
"Yeah, well, how did that work out?"
"Ravi, that isn't fair."
"Fair? Great word."
The woman behind the counter gawped with interest.
"Bands don't last. We'd have been a meteor shower, over before we started."
"Meteor showers are fucking beautiful."
"Come on. You're still with Ella, aren't you?"
"And I could be with Ella and in a successful band, with money. We had that chance, right there." He pointed to the palm of his hand. "Our songs were fire."
Nora hated herself for silently correcting the "our" to "my."
"I don't think your problem was stage fright or wedding fright. I think your problem was life fright."
This hurt. The words took the air out of her.
"And I think your problem," she retaliated, voice trembling, "is blaming others for your shitty life."
He nodded as if slapped, put his magazine back.
"See you around, Nora."
"Tell Joe I said hi," she said, as he walked out of the shop and into the rain.
"Please."
She caught sight of the cover of Your Cat magazine, a ginger tabby. Her mind felt loud, like a Sturm und Drang symphony, as if the ghost of a German composer was trapped inside her mind, conjuring chaos and intensity. The woman behind the counter said something to her she missed.
"Sorry?"
"Nora Seed." The woman, blonde bob, bottle tan, was happy and casual and relaxed, in a way Nora no longer knew how to be. Leaning over the counter on her forearms as if Nora was a lemur at the zoo.
"Yep.
I'm Carrie-Anne. Remember you from school, the swimmer.
Super brain.
Didn't what's-his-face Mr. Blandford do an assembly on you once? Said you were going to end up at the Olympics."
Nora nodded.
"So did you?"
I gave up. Was more into music at the time. Then life happened.
"So what do you do now?"
"I'm between things."
"Got anyone then? Bloke? Kids?"
Nora shook her head, wishing it would fall off. Her own head. Onto the floor. So she'd never had to have a conversation with a stranger ever again.
"Well, don't hang about. Tick tock, tick tock."
"I'm 35. She wished Izzy was here. Izzy never put up with any of this kind of shit. "And I'm not sure I want
Me and Jake were like rabbits, but we got there. Two little terrors. But worth it, you know. I just feel complete. I could show you some pictures.
I get headaches with phones. Dan had wanted kids. Nora didn't know. She'd been petrified of motherhood. The fear of a deeper depression. She couldn't look after herself, let alone anyone else.
Still in Bedford then?
Mm-hmm. Thought you'd be the one that got away. I came back. My mum was ill.
Oh, sorry to hear that. I hope she's okay now.
I'd better go.
But it's still raining.
As Nora escaped the shop, she wished there was nothing but doors ahead of her, which she could walk through one by one, leaving everything behind.
How to be a black hole. 7 hours before she decided to die, Nora was in freefall and she had no one to talk to. Her last hope was her former best friend Izzy, who was over 10,000 miles away in Australia. And things had dried up between them too. She took out her phone and sent Izzy a message.
Hi Izzy, long time no chat. Miss you friend, would be wondrous to catch up. Kiss.
She added another kiss and sent it. Within a minute, Izzy had seen the message. Nora waited in vain for three dots to appear. She passed the cinema where a new Ryan Bailey film was playing tonight. A corny cowboy rom-com called Last Chance Saloon. Ryan Bailey's face seemed to always know deep and significant things. Nora had loved him ever since she'd watched him play a brooding Plato in the Athenians on TV. And since he said in an interview that he'd studied philosophy, she imagined them having deep conversations about Henry David Thoreau through a veil of steam in his West Hollywood hot tub. Go confidently in the direction of your dreams, Thoreau had said. Live the life you've imagined. Thoreau had been her favourite philosopher to study. But who seriously goes confidently in the direction of their dreams? Well, apart from Thoreau. He'd gone and lived in the woods, with no contact from the outside world, to just sit there and write and chop wood and fish. But life was probably simpler 2 centuries ago in Concord, Massachusetts, than modern life in Bedford, Bedfordshire. Or maybe it wasn't. Maybe she was just really crap at it. At life. Whole hours passed by. She wanted to have a purpose, something to give her a reason to exist. But she had nothing. Not even the small purpose of picking up Mr. Banerjee's medication as she had done that 2 days ago. She tried to give a homeless man some money, but realised she had no money.
Cheer up, love. It might never happen, someone said.
Nothing ever did, she thought to herself. That was the whole problem.
Antimatter. 5 hours before she decided to die, as she began walking home, her phone vibrated in her hand. Maybe it was Izzy. Maybe Ravi had told her brother to get in touch. No.
Oh, hi, Doreen.
An agitated voice.
Where were you?
She'd totally forgotten. What time is it?
I've had a really crap day. I'm so sorry. We waited outside your flat for an hour. I can still do Leo's lesson when I get back. I'll be 5 minutes. Too late. He's with his dad now for 3 days.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
She was a waterfall of apologies. She was drowning in herself.
To be honest, Nora, he's been thinking about giving up altogether.
But he's so good.
He's really enjoyed it, but he's too busy. Exams, mates, football, something has to give.
He has a real talent. I've got him into bloody Chopin, please.
A deep, deep sigh. Bye, Nora. Nora imagined the ground opening up, sending her down through the lithosphere and the mantle, not stopping until she reached the inner core compressed into hard, unfeeling metal. 4 hours before she decided to die, Nora passed her elderly neighbour, Mr. Banerjee. Mr. Banerjee was 84 years old,
He was frail, but slightly more mobile since his hip surgery.
It's terrible out, isn't it?
Yes, mumbled Nora. He glanced at his flower bed. The irises are out, though. She looked at the clusters of purple flowers, forcing a smile as she wondered what possible consolation they could offer. His eyes were tired, behind their spectacles. He was at his door fumbling for keys, a bottle of milk and a carrier bag that seemed too heavy for him. It was rare to see him out of the house, a house she had visited during her first month here to help him set up an online grocery shop. Oh, he said now. I have some good news. I don't need you to collect my pills anymore. The boy from the chemist has moved nearby and he says he'll drop them off. Nora tried to reply, but she couldn't get the words out. She nodded instead. He managed to open the door, then closed it, retreating into his shrine to his dear dead wife. That was it. No one needed her. She was superfluous to the universe. Once inside her flat, the silence was louder than noise. The smell of cat food, a bowl still out for Voltaire, half-eaten. She got herself some water and swallowed two antidepressants and stared at the rest of the pills, wondering. 3 hours before she decided to die, her whole being ached with regret. As if the despair in her mind was somehow in her torso and limbs too. As if it had colonized every part of her. It reminded her that everyone was better off without her. You get near a black hole and the gravitational pull drags you into its bleak, dark reality. The thought was like a ceaseless mind cramp, something too uncomfortable to bear yet too strong to avoid. Nora went through her social media. No messages, no comments, no new followers, no friend requests. She was antimatter, with added self-pity. She went on Instagram and saw everyone had worked out how to live, except her. She posted a rambling update on Facebook, which she didn't even really use anymore. 2 hours before she decided to die, she opened a bottle of wine. Old philosophy textbooks looked down at her, ghost furnishings from her university days when life still had possibility. A yucca plant and 3 tiny squat potted cacti. She imagined being a non-sentient life form sitting in a pot all day was probably an easier existence. She sat down at the little electric piano, but played nothing. She thought of sitting by Leo's side, teaching him Chopin's prelude in E minor. Happy moments can turn into pain, given time. There was an old musician's cliche about how there were no wrong notes on a piano. But her life was a cacophony of nonsense. A piece that could have gone in wonderful directions, but now went nowhere at all. Time slipped by. She stared into space. After the wine, a realization hit her with total clarity. She wasn't made for this life. Every move had been a mistake. Every decision a disaster. Every day a retreat from who she imagined she'd be. Swimmer, musician, philosopher, spouse, traveler, glaciologist. Happy, loved, nothing. She couldn't even manage cat owner, or 1 hour a week piano tutor, or human capable of conversation. The tablets weren't working. She finished the wine, all of it. I miss you, she said into the air, as if the spirits of every person she'd loved were in the room with her. She called her brother and left a voicemail when he didn't pick up. I love you, Joe. I just wanted you to know that. There's nothing you could have done. This is about me. Thank you for being my brother. I love you. Bye. It began to rain again.
so she sat there with the blinds open, staring at the drops on the glass. The time was now 11:22. She knew only one thing with absolute certainty. She didn't want to reach tomorrow. She stood up. She found a pen and a piece of paper. It was, she decided, a very good time to die. Dear whoever, I had all the chances to make something of my life, and I blew every one of them. Through my own carelessness and misfortune, the world has retreated from me, and so now it makes perfect sense that I should retreat from the world. If I felt it was possible to stay, I would. But I don't. And so I can't. I make life worse for people. I have nothing to give. I'm sorry. Be kind to each other. Bye. Nora.
0 hours, 0 minutes, 0 seconds.
At first, the mist was so pervasive that she could see nothing else, until slowly she saw pillars appear on either side of her. She was standing on a path, some kind of colonnade. The columns were brain grey with speckles of brilliant blue. The misty vapours cleared like spirits wanting to be unwatched, and a shape emerged. A solid, rectangular shape. The shape of a building. About the size of a church or a small supermarket. It had a stone facade, the same coloration as the pillars, with a large wooden central door and a roof which had aspirations of grandeur, with intricate details and a grand-looking clock on the front gable, with black-painted Roman numerals and its hands pointing to midnight. Tall, dark, arched windows, framed with stone bricks, punctuated the front wall, equidistant from each other. When she first looked, it seemed there were only 4 windows, but a moment later there were definitely 5 of them. She thought she must have miscounted. As there was nothing else around, and since she had nowhere else to be, Nora stepped cautiously towards it. She looked at the digital display of her watch. 00:00:00. Midnight, as the clock had told her. She waited for the next second to arrive, but it didn't. Even as she walked closer to the building, even as she opened the wooden door, even as she stepped inside, the display didn't change. Either something was wrong with her watch, or something was wrong with time. In the circumstances, it could have been either. What's happening? She wondered. What the hell is going on? Maybe this place would hold some answers, she thought, as she walked inside. The place was well lit, and the floor was light stone, somewhere between light yellow and camel brown, like the colour of an old page. But the windows she had seen on the outside weren't there on the inside. In fact, even though she had only taken a few steps forward, she could no longer see the walls at all. Instead, there were bookshelves. Aisles and aisles of shelves, reaching up to the ceiling and branching off from the broad open corridor Nora was walking down. She turned down one of the aisles and stopped to gaze in bafflement at the seemingly endless amount of books. The books were everywhere, on shelves so thin they might as well have been invisible. The books were all green, greens of multifarious shades. Some of these volumes were a murky swamp green, some a bright and light chartreuse, some a bold emerald, and others the verdant shade of summer lawns. And on the subject of summer lawns, despite the fact that the books look old, the air in the library felt fresh. It had a lush, grassy, outdoors kind of smell, not the dusty scent of old tomes. The shelves really did seem to go on forever, straight and long towards a far-off horizon, like lines indicating one-point perspective in a school art project,
broken only by the occasional corridor. She picked a corridor at random and set off. At the next turn, she took a left and became a little lost. She searched for a way out, but there was no sign of an exit. She attempted to retrace her steps towards the entrance, but it was impossible. Eventually, she had to conclude that she wasn't going to find the exit. "This is abnormal," she said to herself, to find comfort in the sound of her own voice. "Definitely abnormal." Nora stopped and stepped closer to some of the books. There were no titles or author names adorning the spines. Aside from the difference of shade, the only other variation was size. The books were of similar height but varied in width. Some had spines 2 inches wide, others significantly less. One or two weren't much more than pamphlets. She reached to pull out one of the books, choosing a medium-sized one in a slightly drab olive colour. It looked a bit dusty and worn. Before she'd pulled it clean from the shelf, she heard a voice behind her and she jumped back. "Be careful," the voice said, and Nora turned around to see who was there. The librarian. "Please, you have to be careful." The woman had arrived seemingly from nowhere, smartly dressed with short grey hair and a turtle green polo neck jumper. About 60, if Nora had to pin it down. "Who are you?" But before she had finished the question, she realized she already knew the answer. "I'm the librarian," the woman said coyly. "That is who." Her face was one of kind but stern wisdom. She had the same neat cropped grey hair she'd always had, with a face that looked precisely as it always did in Nora's mind. For there, right in front of her, was her old school librarian.
"Mrs. Elm."
Mrs. Elm smiled thinly.
"Perhaps."
Nora remembered those rainy afternoons playing chess. She remembered the day her father died, when Mrs. Elm gently broke the news to her in the library. Her father had died suddenly of a heart attack while on the rugby field of the boys' boarding school where he taught. She was numb for about half an hour and had stared blankly at the unfinished game of chess. The reality was simply too big to absorb at first. But then it had hit her hard and sideways, taking her off the track she'd known. She had hugged Mrs. Elm so close, crying into her polo neck until her face was raw from the fusion of tears and acrylic. Mrs. Elm had held her, stroking and smoothing the back of her head like a baby, not offering platitudes or false comforts or anything other than concern. She remembered Mrs. Elm's voice telling her at the time, "Things will get better, Nora. It's going to be all right." It was over an hour before Nora's mother came to pick her up, her brother stoned and numb in the back seat. And Nora had sat in the front next to her mute, trembling mother, saying that she loved her, but hearing nothing back.
"What is this place? Where am I?"
Mrs. Elm smiled, a very formal kind of smile.
"A library, of course.
It's not the school library,
and there's no exit. Am I dead? Is this the afterlife?"
"Not exactly," said Mrs. Elm.
"I don't understand."
"Then let me explain." The Midnight Library. As she spoke, Mrs. Elm's eyes came alive, twinkling like puddles in moonlight. "Between life and death, there is a library," she said. "And within that library, the shelves go on forever. Every book provides a chance to try another life you could have lived. To see how things would be different if you had made other choices. Would you have done anything different if you had the chance to undo your regrets?"
"So I am dead?" Nora asked.
Mrs. Elm shook her head.
"No, listen carefully.
between life and death. She gestured vaguely along the aisle towards the distance. Death is outside.
Well, I should go there, because I want to die.
Nora began walking. But Mrs. Elms shook her head. That isn't how death works.
Why not?
You don't go to death. Death comes to you.
Even death was something Nora couldn't do properly, it seemed. It was a familiar feeling. This feeling of being incomplete in just about every sense. An unfinished jigsaw of a human. Incomplete living and incomplete dying.
So why am I not dead? Why has death not come to me? I gave it an open invitation. I'd wanted to die. But here I am, still existing. I'm still aware of things.
Well, if it's any comfort, you are very possibly about to die. People who pass by the library usually don't stay long, one way or the other.
When she thought about it, and increasingly she had been thinking about it, Nora was only able to think of herself in terms of the things she wasn't, the things she hadn't been able to become. And there really were quite a lot of things she hadn't become. The regrets which were on permanent repeat in her mind. I haven't become an Olympic swimmer. I haven't become a glaciologist. I haven't become Dan's wife. I haven't become a mother. I haven't become the lead singer of the Labyrinths. I haven't managed to become a truly good or truly happy person. I haven't managed to look after Voltaire. And now, last of all, she hadn't even managed to become dead. It was pathetic, really, the amount of possibilities she had squandered. While the Midnight Library stands, Nora, you will be preserved from death. Now, you have to decide how you want to live. The moving shelves. The shelves on either side of Nora began to move. The shelves didn't change angles, they just kept on sliding horizontally. It was possible that the shelves weren't moving at all, but the books were, and it wasn't obvious why or even how. There was no visible mechanism making it happen, and no sound or sight of books falling off the end, or rather the start, of the shelf. The books slid by at varying degrees of slowness, depending on the shelf they were on, but none moved fast. What's happening?
Mrs. Elms' expression stiffened and her posture straightened, her chin retreating a little into her neck. She took a step closer to Nora and clasped her hands together.
It is time, my dear, to begin.
If you don't mind me asking, begin what? Every life contains many millions of decisions, some big, some small. But every time one decision is taken over another, the outcomes differ. An irreversible variation occurs, which in turn leads to further variations. These books are portals to all the lives you could be living.
What?
You have as many lives as you have possibilities. There are lives where you make different choices, and those choices lead you to different outcomes. If you had done just one thing differently, you would have a different life story. And they all exist in the Midnight Library. They are all as real as this life.
Parallel lives?
Not always parallel. Some are more perpendicular.
So do you want to live a life you could be living?
Do you want to do something differently? Is there anything you wish to change?
Did you do anything wrong?
That was an easy one. Yes, absolutely everything. The answer seemed to tickle the librarian's nose. Mrs. Elm quickly rummaged for the paper tissue that was stuffed up the inside sleeve of her polo neck. She brought it quickly to her face and sneezed into it.
Bless you, said Nora, watching as the tissue disappeared from the librarian's hand the moment she'd finished using it, through some strange and hygienic magic.
Don't worry.
Tissues are like lives. There are always more. Mrs. Elm returned to her train of thought. Doing one thing differently is often the same as doing everything differently. Actions can't be reversed within a lifetime, however much we try. But you are no longer within a lifetime. You have popped outside. This is your opportunity, Nora, to see how things could be. This can't be real, Nora thought to herself. Mrs. Elm seemed to know what she was thinking. Oh, it is real, Nora said. But it is not quite reality as you understand it. For want of a better word, it is in between. It is not life. It is not death. It is not the real world in a conventional sense. But nor is it a dream. It isn't one thing or another. It is, in short, the Midnight Library. The slow-moving shelves came to a halt. Nora noticed that on one of the shelves, to her right, at shoulder height, there was a large gap. All the other areas of the shelves around her had the books tightly pressed side by side, but here, lying flat on the thin white shelf, there was only one book. And this book wasn't green like the others. It was grey as the stone on the front of the building when she had seen it through the mist. Mrs. Elm took the book from the shelf and handed it to Nora. She had a slight look of anticipatory pride, as if she'd handed her a Christmas present. It had seemed light when Mrs. Elm was holding it, but it was far heavier than it looked. Nora went to open it. Mrs. Elm shook her head. You always have to wait for my say-so. Why? Every book in here, every book in this entire library, except one, is a version of your life. This library is yours. It is here for you. You see, everyone's lives could have ended up in an infinite number of ways. These books on the shelf are your life, all starting from the same point in time, right now, midnight, Tuesday the 28th of April. But these midnight possibilities aren't the same. Some are similar. Some are very different. This is crackers, said Nora. Except one, this one. Nora tilted the stone grey book towards Mrs. Elm. Mrs. Elm raised an eyebrow. Yes, that one. It's something you have written without ever having to type a word. What? This book is the source of all of your problems, and the answer to them too. But what is it? It is called, my dear, The Book of Regrets. The Book of Regrets. Nora stared at it. She could see it now, the small typeface embossed on the cover. The Book of Regrets. Every regret you have ever had since the day you were born is recorded in here, Mrs. Elm said, tapping her finger on the cover. I now give you permission to open it. As the book was so heavy, Nora sat down cross-legged on the stone floor to do so. She began to skim through it. The book was divided into chapters, chronologically arranged around the years of her life, 0, 1, 2, 3, all the way up to 35. The chapters got much longer as the book progressed year by year, but the regrets she accumulated weren't specifically related to that year in question. Regrets ignore chronology. They float around. The sequence of these lists changes all the time. Right. Yes, that makes sense, I suppose. She quickly realized they ranged from the minor and quotidian, I regret not doing exercise today, to the substantial, I regret not telling my father I loved him before he died. There were continual background regrets which repeated on multiple pages. I regret not staying in the labyrinths because I let down my brother. I regret not staying in the labyrinths because I let down myself. I regret not doing more for the environment. I regret the time I spent on social media. I regret not going to Australia with Izzy. I regret not having more fun when I was younger. I regret all those arguments with Dad. I regret not working with animals. I regret not doing geology at university instead of philosophy. I regret not learning how to be a happier person. I regret feeling so much guilt. I regret not sticking at Spanish. I regret not choosing science subjects in my A-levels. I regret not becoming a glaciologist. I regret not getting married. I regret not applying to do a master's degree in philosophy at Cambridge. I regret not keeping healthy. I regret moving to London. I regret not going to Paris to teach English. I regret not finishing the novel I started at university. I regret moving out of London. I regret having a job with no prospects. I regret not being a better sister. I regret not having a gap year after university. I regret disappointing my father. I regret that I teach piano more than I play it. I regret my financial mismanagement. I regret not living in the countryside. Some regrets were a little fainter than others. One regret shifted from practically invisible to bold and back again, as if it was flashing on and off right there as she looked at it. The regret was, I regret not yet having children. That is a regret that sometimes is and sometimes isn't, explained Mrs. Elm, again somehow reading her mind. There are a few of those. From the age of 34 onwards, in the longest chapter at the end of the book, there were a lot of Dan's specific regrets. These were quite strong and bold, and played in her head like an ongoing fortissimo chord in a Haydn concerto. I regret being cruel to Dan. I regret breaking up with Dan. I regret not living in a country pub with Dan. As she stared down at the pages, she thought now of the man she had so nearly married. Regret overload. She'd met Dan while living with Izzy in Tooting. Big smile, short beard, visually a TV vet. Fun, curious. He drank quite a bit, but always seemed immune to hangovers. He had studied art history and put his in-depth knowledge of Rubens and Tintoretto to incredible use by becoming head of PR for a brand of protein flapjacks. He did, however, have a dream. And his dream was to run a pub in the countryside. A dream he wanted to share with her, with Nora. And she got carried away with his enthusiasm, got engaged, but suddenly she realized she didn't want to marry him. Deep down, she was scared of becoming her mother. She didn't want to replicate her parents' marriage. Still staring blankly at the book of regrets, she wondered if her parents had ever been in love, or if they'd got married because marriage was something you did at the appropriate time with the nearest available person. A game where you grabbed the first person you could find when the music stopped. She had never wanted to play that game. Bertrand Russell wrote that, to fear love is to fear life, and those who fear life are already three parts dead. Maybe that was her problem. Maybe she was just scared of living. But Bertrand Russell had more marriages and affairs than hot dinners, so perhaps he was no one to give advice. When her mum died 3 months before the wedding, Nora's grief was immense. Though she had suggested that the date should be put back, it somehow never was, and Nora's grief fused with depression and anxiety and the feeling that her life was out of her own control. The wedding seemed such a symptom of this chaotic feeling that she felt tied to a train track, and the only way she could loosen the ropes and free herself was to pull out of the wedding. Though in reality, staying in Bedford and being single and letting Izzy down about their Australia plans and starting work at String Theory and getting a cat had all felt like the opposite of freedom. Oh no, said Mrs. Elm, breaking Nora's thoughts. It's too much for you. And suddenly she was back, feeling all this contrition, all that pain of letting people down and letting herself down. The pain she had tried to escape less than an hour ago. The regrets began to swarm together.
In fact, while staring at the open pages of the book, the pain was actually worse than it had been wandering around Bedford. The power of all the regrets simultaneously emanating from the book was becoming agony. The weight of guilt and remorse and sorrow too strong. She leaned back on her elbows, dropped the heavy book and squeezed her eyes shut. She could hardly breathe, as if invisible hands were around her neck.
Make it stop!
Close it now, instructed Mrs. Elm. Close the book. Not just your eyes, close it. You have to do it yourself. So Nora, feeling like she was about to pass out, sat back up and placed her hand under the front cover. It felt even heavier now, but she managed to close the book and gasped in relief. Every life begins now. Well? Mrs. Elm had her arms folded. Though she looked identical to the Mrs. Elm Nora had always known, her manner was definitely a little more brusque. It was Mrs. Elm, but somehow not Mrs. Elm. It was quite confusing. Well, what? Nora said, still gasping, still relieved she could no longer feel the intensity of all her regrets simultaneously. Which regret stands out? Which decision would you like to undo? Which life would you like to try on? She said that, precisely. Try on. As if this was a clothes shop and Nora could choose a life as easily as a t-shirt. It felt like a cruel game. That was agony. I felt like I was about to be strangled. What is the point of this? As Nora looked up, she noticed the lights for the first time. Just naked bulbs hanging down from wires attached to the ceiling, which seemed like a normal kind of light grey ceiling. Except it was a ceiling that reached no walls. Like the floor here, it went on forever. The point is, there is a strong possibility that your old life is over. You wanted to die, and maybe you will. And you will need somewhere to go to. Somewhere to land, another life. So you need to think hard. This library is called the Midnight Library because every new life on offer here begins now. And now is midnight. It begins now, all these futures, that's what is here. That's what your books represent. Every other immediate, present, and ongoing future you could have had. So there are no pasts in there. No. Just the consequence of them. But those books are also written, and I know them all. But they are not for you to read. And when does each life end? It could be seconds, or hours, or it could be days, months, more. If you have found a life you truly want to live, then you get to live it until you die of old age. If you really want to live a life hard enough, you don't have to worry. You will stay there as if you've always been there. Because in one universe you have always been there. The book will never be returned, so to speak. It becomes less of a loan and more of a gift. The moment you decide you want that life, really want it, then everything that exists in your head now, including this midnight library, will eventually be a memory so vague and intangible it will hardly be there at all. One of the lights flickered overhead. The only danger, continued Mrs. L. more ominously, is when you're here, between lives. If you lose the will to carry on, it will affect your root life, your original life. And that could lead to the destruction of this place. You'd be gone forever. You'd be dead, and so would your access to all of this. That's what I want. I want to be dead. I would be dead because I want to be. That's why I took the overdose. I want to die. Well, maybe. Or maybe not. After all, you're still here. Nora tried to get her head around this. So how do I return to the library, if I'm stuck in a life even worse than the one I've just left? It can be subtle, but as soon as disappointment is felt in full, you'll come back here. Sometimes the feeling creeps up, other times it comes all at once. If it never arrives, you'll stay put, and you will be happy there, by definition. It couldn't be simpler. So pick something you would have done differently, and I will find you the book.
That is to say, the life. Nora stared down at the Book of Regrets lying closed on the yellow-brown floor tiles. She remembered chatting late at night with Dan about his dream of owning a quaint little pub in the country. His enthusiasm had been infectious, and it had almost become her dream too. I wish I hadn't left Dan, and that I was still in a relationship with him. I regret us not staying together and working towards that dream. Is there a life where we're still together? Of course, said Mrs. Elm. The books in the library began to move again, as though the shelves were conveyor belts. This time, though, instead of going as slow as a wedding march, they moved faster and faster and faster, until they couldn't really be seen as individual books at all. They just whirred by in streams of green. Then, just as suddenly, they stopped. Mrs. Elm crouched down and took a book from the lowest shelf to her left. The book was one of the darker shades of green. She handed it to Nora. It was a lot lighter than the Book of Regrets, even though it was a similar size. Again, there was no title on the spine, but a small one embossed on the front, precisely the same shade as the rest of the book. It said, My Life. But it's not my life. Oh, Nora, they are all your lives. What do I do now?